This is Jim DeBacchus on the left.
Thomas Wright on the right.
I'm Natalie Gochner, and you're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. On today's program, we're going to talk about Ferguson, Missouri. Could that happen in Utah? We talk about Uber and Lyft, the alternative transportation companies, and how do we blend them in with existing taxi service? It's college football time, what's going on, and elections to the state school board. But first, this news. I'm Natalie Gochner, and you are listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. It's a lively and informative political discussion, and I represent the political center. On the left, I am joined by State Senator Jim DeBacchus. Welcome, Jim.
Good morning.
And on the right, it's my pleasure to welcome to the program political guru and former chair of the Utah Republican Party, Thomas Wright. Welcome, Thomas.
Thanks for having me.
Thomas, we love having you in the show because, you know, you're a little smarter than Greg, but we only say that because he's out of town right now.
Yeah, let's pile on, by the way.
Exactly.
He's out of town, perhaps won't be listening to the show. I wanted to start this morning's program by just talking about, it's kind of a sobering thing happening in our country right now. It's the events in Ferguson, Missouri. Just one of these things that this country's become acquainted with, where from time to time, because of the, what's the right way to characterize it, Jim? The things that happen in race relations, the things that happen in socioeconomic classes, the things that happen with police overreach puts us in a situation where we have our country kind of fighting against itself. And I guess I want to just ask the question, put a little local angle on it. Could this happen in Utah, Jim? Could something of this magnitude, where you have to actually bring out the National Guard because of a race relation issue, happen in Utah?
You know, you have to look to the much broader level about what's happening. You can't just say this incident or that incident. It happens in communities as people separate out into separate camps, racially and ethnically and religiously, in our community in particular. And everybody has their camps. And the feedback is circular, and everybody is sure what they're hearing is right. You add in an element of police departments that are not representative of their community, and they're not representative of the tribes that are in a community. So Ferguson had two or three police officers out of 200 or 300 that were ethnically matching the community. Then you add in what I think is a fear by particularly older white people. As they look around and see the racial change of their country changing, they feel threatened. This doesn't look like the country that they grew up with. You add all of those elements, and you have the basis for not just one little incident in Ferguson, but things that could pop up all over the country. And you ask, could it happen in Utah? It could happen in Utah. We have a system that simply refuses to accept and have reflect back into the community some of the racial groups that are emerging in Utah, and they're not represented. Mm-hmm. We have 72 district court judges. We have 3 ethnic and racial minorities, and yet 34% of the people standing before those judges are ethnic or racial minority in criminal cases. The police departments are not very well balanced back to the community. A lot of the representatives on city councils, West Valley City does not have a Hispanic member, and yet the population. I'm saying, be that as it may politically, one party or another party or whatever, it is not healthy for a community to not have all the ethnic groups speaking to each other and feeling part of a broader community. And it's desperately wrong to not have those in authority feel like, or people feel like, somebody from their tribe is not in authority and carrying a badge, and they have some say. That's the kind of problem, and we have it in Utah, and we have a lot in our community that just refuse to accept that, mm-hmm. even as an issue.
Thomas, do you see this any differently?
I think Jim made some great points. I think it's important to not put down peaceful protest and demonstration. I mean, that is one of the hallmarks of our country, I think, that makes our country great, that people, when they feel like they're wronged or they feel like government has overstepped its bounds or government isn't being transparent, that they have the right to protest to make changes. Sometimes those protests cross the line and they turn violent. And, you know, you've seen some videos online that have clearly done that. But just yesterday at the St. Louis County Justice Center in Clayton, where that grand jury was expected to convene, there was a peaceful protest gathered in a circle for prayer, you know, demanding some changes. And those are positive things for our community. And I think Jim's right when you say, when you bring a police force in from outside of the community, they're not as invested as in the community as they should be, and they don't understand the dynamics of the community as much. And let's be honest. I mean, this all started because of lack of transparency. I mean, what happened in Ferguson, they didn't want to talk about what happened. They didn't want to disclose the facts. They were slow with the details. It looked like a cover-up. It looked like a cover-up to me from where I'm sitting.
Yeah, I mean, you
just couldn't find anything out. So, you know, there's a lot to be learned from the situation, and I think it can happen just about anywhere.
Wow. Sober thoughts. Jim, have you had interaction with Chief Burbank? Thomas, have you had an interaction with Chief Burbank enough to know what kind of police chief we have in our largest city police force?
I think the biggest danger with Chief Burbank is that Los Angeles or New York or Chicago is going to realize how good he is, and he's going to be gone.
Going to take him.
I mean, he's truly one of the best police chiefs of police I have ever seen in the country.
Yeah, in my interaction with him, I have felt the same way. Thomas?
Yeah, no, I think, I mean, you judge somebody by the results they produce, and, you know, he's been effective in a lot of different arenas. I haven't personally interacted with him a lot, so I can't speak to him personally.
Yeah.
But I just judge somebody that I haven't interacted personally by the results they produce, and he seems to have produced those.
Yeah. Well, so now we have a situation. This is a difficult, delicate transition, but where the Salt Lake PD, or at least Salt Lake City, issues tickets on the old transportation, alternative transportation companies. I'm speaking about Uber and Lyft. These you know, transportation network companies. And after three citations, they give them a $6,500 ticket for operating in the city without a commercial license. Is that overreach?
How does this work?
How does it work? You're sitting at the Salt Lake Airport. You just got off your plane. You open up an app, and you basically just signal you need a ride from the Salt Lake Airport to a set destination, and someone picks you up in their own private automobile and gives you great service and doesn't charge very much.
You should try it, Jim. It works really well.
People love it.
It's a lot cheaper, or it is cheaper, or it's the same as taxis.
I don't think the selling point is that it's cheaper. I think it's that it's more efficient and it's quicker. You know, there's been reports in Salt Lake City that people have waited up to 2-3 hours for somebody to come and pick them up. And when we're trying to engage people that are, you know, drinking, hey, don't drink and drive, and they have to wait 2 or 3 hours, you know, you're just incenting them to do the wrong thing. I always laugh at these situations. Why does government try to thwart innovation, you know, with regulatory fees and antiquated regulations? It's just ridiculous. I imagine when the horse and buggy industry saw the automobile, they did the same thing. Why can't we allow our country to move forward? Why does government always have to intervene and slap $6,500 fines on people that know they're getting into a private automobile, that know the system that they've signed up for? Don't we have the right and freedom as citizens to do that?
Mm-hmm.
I just think the government really missed the mark on this one.
I serve on the Salt Lake City Airport Board with Mickey Gallivan and with David Abera. Now, these are gentlemen who you would not say are millennials. They are, you know, what, in their late 50s, early 60s, something like that. I don't know. Maybe I'm being generous.
I think they're in their 40s. But
in any case, they love these systems. They use them all over the place. And it's been eye-opening to me to know of the depth of penetration in the market.
So within 4 or 5 minutes, you get on your cell phone, you boom, they are, there's somebody, this is your neighbor, they're there in their home car.
You rate them when you get off, they rate off. You.
Yeah. If you leave something in the car, you can hit a button, they'll come back around, bring you your phone back.
Okay, now what the city has...
I guess you can't hit your phone if it's in the car, but you get what I'm saying.
Yeah.
The city, though, has, like virtually all American cities, has set up this whole bureaucracy and this whole investment in taxis, and it has made certain guarantees to people that own taxis and own taxi cab companies and the rest. If we're going to allow other people to do this, what do we owe to the people that invested in the infrastructure of the old system.
Well, that just begs the question, why is the government doing that? I mean, that speaks to the conservative principle of free enterprise and private markets, and let's get the government out of that business. Why is the government guaranteeing taxi companies the ability to succeed? That's why we're in the mess we're in this country, with the debt and the inefficiency and the bureaucracy that we have. I mean, when I get in a car with Uber, I know for a fact they've checked the driver, they've checked the car, they've checked the insurance policy. I trust the private sector on that, those things a lot more than I trust somebody at City Hall.
So this is an issue of freedom and fairness from the political middle. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. In our next segment, we're going to talk about the state school board and how people are appointed there.
This is Jim DeBacchus on the left.
Thomas Wright on the right.
And I'm Natalie Gochner in the political center, and I can't get over the fact that Thomas Wright represents the right.
You should
be
not quite
Jim
right
left.
About that.
Jim left.
Jim left.
Yeah, exactly.
In our first segment, we talked about Uber and Lyft and how government reacts to that, acknowledging that government's sort of slow to change to new things that happen. I'm looking at the state school board and the Utah State Constitution, 1896 document. We have in this state a school board that in some sense operates as a, you know, fourth branch of government, if you will. And this year we have the candidates that will be on the state school board. They have a lot of power and nobody knows who they are. Everybody thinks that the governor has education power. Most candidates for governor want to be an education governor. And then you realize very quickly that the governor basically has no power. You go to cabinet meetings of a governor and transportation's represented, the environment's represented, healthcare's represented. There's no education there on the cabinet. It begs the question that education's a little too tradition-bound as well. Thomas, how do you see the state school board in our state, its role, its power, elections?
Well, it's really a tough issue, Natalie, because there's so many people that care about education in our state, and there's all these entities, as you say, that have a voice at the table, and that's a positive thing. The problem is that, again, there's so much bureaucracy that it's difficult for anybody to make any forward progress and change. And I think the part of the Utah School Board that is the most troubling to people right now is the fact that they work for the public, and a lot of what they have been doing has not been in the public eye. In other words, there are accusations now out that there has not been transparency. And as soon as those claims had been made, the two ranking people in the Utah State School Board decided to retire early, which just causes everybody to wonder, well, what is it that they're trying to hide? Now, I'm not saying that they had anything to hide or not. Mm-hmm. We'll let the facts come to light. But we've got to do a better job in our state of educating ourselves about how this education system works. Mm-hmm. And you're right. I mean, we're blaming the governor, we're blaming the legislator, but legislature, and maybe sometimes they do need to be blamed, but there are other entities out there that are making it very hard to make forward progress with our education system.
I've learned in working with business leaders that one of the first things you do when you're trying to make progress as a company is look at governance and make sure that you've got the right structure in place to be successful. And when I look at education in this state, Jim, the governance structure is a piece of work. You know, who is in charge?
We have a kerfuffle here. And
love the word.
Can you spell that?
Right. Get Google out. It goes right back to the founding fathers, and they wanted education treated special, and so they set up this autonomous state board of education, and they are out there doing their thing. The legislature is doing its thing, giving money. The governor's pretending that he's running things. You got local school boards, and you know what? Our system is unique, and it's terrible, and it may well be one of the reasons why we are in the catastrophic situation we're in education. Biggest classrooms in America, lowest per child by $980, graduation rates down 6.5% over the last 10 years. We aren't in danger of losing children. We have lost this war. And Utah is so proud of everything it's doing. We are doing a terrible job, and we got to stop patting ourselves on the back as being a great state until we rectify our biggest problem. And we can't be afraid to talk about it. So, the basis of that change might well be dumping this constitutional gizmo and coming back with something that says, governor runs education, the legislature funds it, and we elect a governor and say
hold them accountable.
To that governor, you got 4 years or you're out.
So you know, it's back to school time. We're all thinking about it. Our kids are in these schools. You know, imagine if you could spend $900 more per student, what you could buy with that. It's attractive to me. How do you, Thomas, elevate this to the status of where it actually becomes a statewide public issue? In other words, we'll have a gubernatorial campaign in a couple of years here. How do you get a governor to campaign on something big for public education?
Well, I don't know how you get the governor to do it, but I think what you have to do is you have to help people understand that their voice at the table is important. And I think you have to get all the shareholders that have a voice at the table, in other words, the governor, the legislature, the school boards, the PTA, mm-hmm. the teachers, and you have to say to them, the system is broken, like Jim is saying. We all have to admit first that the system is broken, and that even though we may be playing a role in it, we may have to redefine the role that we're playing. Mm-hmm. And until we get people willing to do that and not say, well, it's not us. You know, if we just had more money, then all our problems would be solved. It's you guys for not giving us the money. It just gets into this back and forth. We all have to sit down at the table, so to speak, and say, and not wait for the public. I mean, the public is trusting the people that they're electing and the people on the school board and teachers to say, hey, educate my kids to the best of your ability. So let's not wait for some groundswell of public opinion. Let's make the changes now. And if all the shareholders come to the table and say, we can do better, then we all can do better collectively.
Well, so Jim, you know, quotes all these things that would say that our public education system's in crisis, these large class sizes, the graduation rates, all these sorts of things. And yet last Friday, this state got a jobs report that was so stellar that it was highlighted in the Wall Street Journal. Earlier this week, Governor Herbert was public about how he created like a million jobs in 10 days or something like that. And Jim, I don't know how you get this state to confront its education woes, which will be a long-term problem for us, if in the short time we are one of the stars in the country economically.
Well, you gotta go down on some of those tabs that the governor has. And we are creating jobs, but they are low-paying, not-sustain-a-family kind of jobs, most of them. If you go down to where the action is, if you go down to where the future is, go down to northern Utah County, go down to the places where we're building the $75,000 and $100,000 jobs that are going to keep us competitive and turn us into the kind of state that we want to be in the next 100 years, we're doing catastrophically bad. We're not graduating enough kids to fill an expansion of Adobe. They can't build another 1,000 jobs there because we're not investing in the kind of education that allows their graduates to come and take those jobs. So it's one thing to create call center jobs and get the numbers and, oh, aren't we doing good, and pat ourselves on the back. Our children are not going to be sustaining healthy families on $10, $12 an hour jobs. We were failing in the higher end where our kids need those serious jobs. Our complete lack of funding education on the higher level is a different issue that we also need to talk to. We have got to the point now where we're raising tuition so high, it's at a historic high point, the amount that children, our youngsters, are paying as a part of the state tuition. The state has moved back dramatically. Our kids are paying. They're borrowing. Everything is backwards. We need to bite the bullet. We're going to have to raise taxes, and we're going to have to make the commitment to the next generation.
Thomas, how do you see the strong economics in Utah right now, but these education woes?
Well, when you talk to business leaders in the state, they tell you exactly what Jim said earlier, and that is that the jobs that are related to science and engineering and math, they are not filling with Utahns. And they tell you, anywhere you go, I could name several business leaders, I won't single them out, that have told me, we have to go out of state to fill those positions. Mm-hmm. And so it's a combination of the fact that, one, we can't fill them here because our kids aren't educated enough now, and that's only going to get worse. So I agree with Jim in that we have to address this now. We have to have leaders who can forecast future problems and not just look at it today. It's great that Utah's doing so well, and we should all pat ourselves on the back for about 20 seconds, and then we should ask ourselves the question, how are we going to be great in 10 and 20 and 30 years?
Yeah, yeah.
And are our leaders doing what they need to do to keep us competitive? What's happening right now is the status quo. We need to move forward. We need to get our kids more competitive.
Yeah, I love it.
And And it won't happen with the way we're doing it.
I love it. In these golden moments on both sides of the aisle, when the left, right, and center all feel the same about a really important issue. And it sounds like we all are concerned about education.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, let's go to higher ed for a minute, but not talk about higher ed in the frame of funding and school boards and things like that, but talk about it in terms of college football, which is a love of most people in this state. As we do that, I want to remind listeners that you're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle, and I'm joined by Jim DeBacchus and Thomas Wright. I'm Natalie Gochner. I work up at the University of Utah. I'm leaving the campus the other day, and I drive by the football practice field and facility and see all these hot, sweaty, big men returning
Where's
to their
this
cars.
Going?
Yeah. Well, it reminds me. And then I hear on campus the band practicing, and you can just feel college football in the air. Yeah. And yet it's an interesting time for college football because you have all these issues with protection of these athletes with concussions. You have issues where some universities talking about paying their players. Exciting time, Thomas, for college football.
I am a huge college football fan and enjoy going to that environment that you just described. But I think that football has some serious challenges. There are some serious head injuries that are still not coming to light. They're in complete denial about how hard they're hitting each other and the damage that they're doing to young adults. And the NFL's in denial, too. I think football will continue to struggle. The class action lawsuit that was settled for $700 million was a joke. Mm-hmm. I don't even know why they settled for that amount. They did, but it will just continue to come up.
Yeah.
Football's in trouble because, when people find out that their kids playing Little League football are sustaining head injuries that are going to affect them later on in life, they won't be playing football anymore.
Yeah, that's right. You have some sons?
I do.
And then you can let them play?
He's an avid golfer. He's not playing football. And I'll be honest with you, there was a time when his friends were all playing where we kind of encouraged him to look at other sports because I do believe that there are permanent head injuries. And having had a father that, suffered from Alzheimer's for 20 years and then passed away, they think that Alzheimer's may have something to do with early, head injuries early on and the inflammation of the brain that's created by those blows.
Yeah.
And I'm just not willing to take that risk until they're honest about what's really going on.
Yeah, makes sense. This is a good time for me to pitch, get your kids into soccer, the world's game. Jim, how do you feel on this issue?
Always soccer. Well, it's a financial issue in part. It's about time that this giant honeypot of money that the players got some of it. It just is. The fact that they run out of food at the end of the month sometimes,
right.
The fact that their parents can't see them play, the fact that billions and billions of dollars come rolling in, and every assistant athletic director and every average college football coach at Utah makes over $200,000 a year. The highest paid guy in the state is Kyle Whittingham. Makes $1.78 million a year. So I'm saying that as long as there's that much money, it's not going to hurt to give the kids $200 or $300 a month so they can have a decent life. And we really do need to change the rules, this whole head-hitting thing and that serious damage that happens. I think the NAACP needs to take a look at it.
A lot of agreement on both sides of the aisle today. It's time for us to turn to gripes. I wonder if I should gripe that you guys are both alike and we don't have enough disparity in opinion here today. Jim, do you have a gripe?
Just get us going. All right. My good friends at Chamber of Commerce, give me a break.
Bring it on, Jim.
I got a letter from Mike Lee saying the chamber has honored me by allowing me to be the keynote speaker on a big conference here. And we're going to talk about government regulation and compliance. I'm bringing in Tom Colburn. I'll be there. The lieutenant governor is going to be there. Herbert
sounds
is
like
going to be
great
wandering
event.
Around. You know, Chamber of Commerce, there's two parties in our state. I'm a member, supposedly. Once could you invite a Democrat just even to be a token on a panel? You talk about Ferguson. Hello, Chamber. Wake up. There are two sides to issues.
So I'm going to be on one of those panels later today, Jim, and I will make that point. Thomas?
Thank you.
My gripe is probably pretty predictable, but the partisanship in Washington, D.C. has to end. Mm. I can't believe they recess when there's a humanitarian crisis at the border of Mexico. There's all these problems all in our country, in our world, and these politicians are fine just to head on home and take a 5-week break. Nobody running a business would do that. There's nobody out there who works for a business that would do that. Only our government is capable of just walking taking away when they're needed most. And I hold every single one of them accountable, Republican and Democrat. They need to explain to their voters why they're on vacation, when the country is completely falling apart.
Yeah, go figure. Another point we'll have agreement on. My gripe deals with another common gripe of people, but it came to me this week. I'm driving along 7th East, and the lights don't feel very synced to me. And I know, you know, when you talk to traffic engineers, they'll say, oh, this, and all of a sudden your mind's all confused. But I drive State Street quite a bit during rush hour, and those lights are synced.
Yeah.
I can tell you from experience, they work. Why don't we have that more commonly in our state? You've been listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. Great having you join us on the program today, which has been produced by Jesse Ellis. Thanks for listening.